I am Planta on the line in Vancouver, British Columbia at thecommentary.ca. Moon Calves is the debut novel of the writer Victoria Hetherington. She joins me now to discuss the book's characters who find themselves members of a cult. We discuss these young people and the sort of traits that make them drawn to joining a cult or susceptible and being lured into one. We discuss Joseph, the leader of the cult, his motivation to form this group, and just how charismatic he is to others. There are also many themes in this book that the author contends with, like artificial intelligence, first love, obsession, ambition, sex, and more. We'll touch on some of these themes, as well as writing. Victoria Hetherington is the author of the digital fiction project I Have to Tell You. She lives in Toronto, but she joined me from Duncan, British Columbia, while on book tour last week. The book is published by Now or Never. Please welcome to the Plant Online program, Victoria Hetherington. Ms. Hetherington, good morning.
Hello.
Thanks for joining us.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Is there much research that one has to do? I know it's a novel, but is there research that you have to do in terms of what a cult is or what people who are in cults are like?
Absolutely. The grain of the novel, I suppose, was sort of created when I was talking to my mother about a decade ago. She very casually, perhaps too casually, mentioned that in the late 70s, she was up in rural Quebec sunbathing, and she was approached by a couple of young women who seemed a little bit off but very interested in her and wanted her to come along with them. And I think there was mention of a compound or a commune.
Mm-hmm.
And and something felt a little bit off, and so she kind of jumped ship at the last minute and didn't end up going back with them. And I was fascinated by this and shaken. And so I did some research, and it turns out that it was probably a few recruiters from one specific Quebec-based cult that was fairly prominent in the late 70s and early 80s. And so I actually purchased all the books that there are.
Mm-hmm.
About the cult itself, and really got to sort of dig into what it was all about, and sort of more generally, cult psychology in general. But yeah, there was quite a bit of research involved.
As I was starting the book, I was thinking about cults and my knowledge of them, and it's largely from what I've seen on television or in films. And I tend to think, yeah, it's from the 70s or the 60s, that kind of thing, before the internet, say. But as I'm reading your book, I realized just how even now people can still be taken by them and specifically by certain charismatic people, right?
Oh, yeah, of course. Now I would argue that there's a lot of sort of cultish organizations, but it's sort of maybe framed as, a yoga retreat in which there's a really strict diet and a very compelling personality and I suppose with this fictive cult in particular, I sort of had to sit down and think, well, what would a doomsday cult in 2017 or 18,
yeah,
is when I was writing this, what would they be freaked out about? What would the end of the world be to them? And that was sort of how I got to AI and, the sort of the doomsday idea of like, well, our machine overlords aren't going to be nice to us, so let's all escape to a little commune.
And that's something that one realizes because people are talking about driverless cars even. And mm-hmm. Some people have those vacuums, that clean your house without you, those robo-vacuums.
Roomba.
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. It's happening around us, it's only going to be faster. And conceivably, a lot of people are already scared about this sort of stuff, right?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. There seems to be sort of if you think about the people in Silicon Valley, there's sort of, I think, a lot of excitement about it,
Yeah.
And they just can't wait to be, for their robot arms and their nanobots to fix their enzymes and then just to generally kind of meld with technology, and I think that that's an optimistic view, and
uh-huh.
I think Yeah, and there's some thinkers, like transhumanists, like Ray Kurzweil, for example, who are really excited about it. And I think that, you know, a lot of it has to do with fearing your own mortality, right? And I think in certain strong AI scenarios, there's a possibility that that, you know, immortality might be an option. But on the other hand, there are people who think that, well, you know, if and when AI becomes smarter than humans, yeah, you know, it'll get smarter and smarter, and then who knows if it'll be nice to us or not.
Right.
And so there's the paranoid kind of school of thought. So.
Yeah, yeah. And you can get, some people can deep dive this stuff on the internet and then get consumed by it, and then it ruins their life. For a guy, I'll begin with the character Joseph, because that's my name. What are some of the traits, or what are some of the feelings that he has in terms of what propels him to, I guess he's the leader of this cult, is that right?
He is, yes.
Yeah, so what are some of the things that are top of mind in him and his future, say?
You know, that's interesting. Somebody pointed out at my Toronto launch, they had a really good question that sort of stumped me. I kind of spaced out into the audience and tried to kind of formulate my thoughts. She said, "Why is the cult so small? You know, why aren't there more people?" And I suppose, yeah, I had to think about it, and I was like, "Well, you know, in a way, it sort of mimics a really messed up family, you know." It's sort of small. It's about five people. And I think unconsciously, I think that Joseph was sort of trying to, sorry, I know that's your name.
Yeah.
That character was trying to create a little family for himself. I don't think his ambitions stretched much beyond that. I don't think that he had the organizational capacity for that. And I think that that's an aspect of it too. But I also think though that he believes in that sort of strong AI paranoia, you know. I think that he actually is sincere in that belief, and that he wants to make the best life possible for his little, you know, cult family. And so I think that there's sincerity there, even though he's obviously quite horrible and messed up. And so, yeah, I think his motivation is to create a little family for himself, A, and B, to protect it however he can, and failing that, you know, take them out of their misery.
Right. And so what's also fascinating as I'm reading the book is to see what draws people to join a cult, and especially these people that join Joseph. Because we all realize, in a way, that cults are bad. They're weird and they're bad, but these folks got hooked in anyway. What sort of people are they?
That's a good question. You know, after my mom told me about that, about her scrape with it, well, her sort of brush with it, I thought, you know, I think part of why I'm so spooked by this is because if it were me in her position, especially at the age I was when she told me, I might have said yes. I think that I have the kind of personality that, you know, I'm you know, especially at the age of about 20 or 20, 23, or around the age of the cult members, I was very suggestible, very easy to eager to please, very, very susceptible to strong personalities and almost willing to be told what to do, if sort of subtextually. So I think part of what made it so interesting to me to assemble this little fictional cult was because I could sort of recognize myself in these fictional, you know, cult members, to be honest.
Yeah, and that's the other thing that struck me as I was getting to know some of these cult members, was that they are quite young. And at the same time, they speak like young people do. They're reverent, they're somewhat amusing, they're colorful. And so that sort of writing that you had to do in terms of their voice, was that fun to do as a writer?
Oh, so much fun. I figured that this book is so dark, that there had to be humor in there.
Mm.
And I think that probably informed the decision to make the cult a lot smaller, so that you could really focus in on the small, you know, humorous day-to-day interactions rather of the cult members. Because I think people misunderstanding each other, and I think that that is a source of super dark comedy and expectations kind of coming from one person and not really matching another person. Mm-hmm. You know, there's sort of tragic comedy there too. And so I figured that in order to make this work and readable, it had to be kind of in a way one long black comedy. So I think that the dialogue and the way that the cult members interact with each other, I felt like that was a pretty good means, a pretty good way to inject some levity.
Some of the themes that you touch upon in the book, and you've alluded to this just a moment ago, and that's first love. It's something important, obviously, in one's life, but it usually happens in those formative years when, you know, one's character isn't, say, formed or developed yet. And so it can really screw you up, you know, if it goes badly. And so when you write about something like that, especially, you know, coupled with the other things that you touch upon in the book, like sexual obsession, ambition, some of these characters really aren't equipped to contend with these sort of life experiences at that point in their life, are they?
No, not at all. And I think that their vulnerability and in some cases their innocence, and in other cases their massive egos, it makes them, you know, really, really vulnerable and susceptible to being charmed, you know, to falling in a kind of love with this man. To draw from The Sopranos, you know, it's an amour fou, you know, it's a crazy love, yeah. Further, just, you know, to sort of finish that up, there was a friend of mine when I was writing the book was talking about being in love, and he said, you know, I've never loved anyone like this before. And I was like, dude, I've known you for like 6 years. Like, you know, you've definitely been in love like this before. And he was like, well, I don't remember.
Yeah.
And I thought about it. Yeah. And I was like, well, you know, in a way, you're right. You know, it's like in that Raymond Carver story, what we talk about when we talk about love, when at the very end, the characters realize they loved each other so much, and now they don't remember what that was like. They despise each other. So, in a way, you know, it's first love, or it feels like first love, even for the older people who have perhaps been in love before.
It's a first love all over again, right?
Yeah, I think so.
the voices the narrators in the book, it's different chapter by chapter, and you write in different styles as well. Was that it was obviously on purpose for you to do that. Where did that come from, say? Where did the inspiration to write the book as you did come from?
So, well, that's a great question. When I was reading one book in particular about the cults that I won't name, because I believe that if not the leader, then some of the people involved are currently still alive. One particular narrative book, the narrative was sort of informed by this super kind of omniscient narrator. And I thought, well, oh man, I'd love to hear from, you know, so-and-so woman in the cult who lost her baby, or, you know, this, yeah. You know, and so I thought, you know what, maybe it might be cool and good and useful to hear from as many people as possible, not only from a sort of, you know, a weird kind of ethical standpoint, but also because I thought that would make it kind of interesting and kind of challenging.
Yeah.
Because not all of them are reliable narrators. So
right.
you can kind of pick and choose what you think is actually true at certain points.
Yeah, and so was that fun for you then to write that way, rather than say the sort of ways that people tell you you're supposed to write a novel?
So much fun.
Yeah, I'll bet.
You get to be playful.
Right. Now, you've written before, but this is the first novel that's been published. What was the process like? I mean, you mentioned it was playful to do. When you're writing it, are you, say, do you have an eye to what the reader might think? Are you thinking about that while you're doing it, say?
Absolutely. You know, I wrote a lot of it at one of the loneliest points in my life. At the time, it sort of felt as if I was speaking to someone, which is such a cliche, but it's true. So it was almost like acting, you know, because I was speaking as this person and speaking as that character and this character. And so that was interesting, and that was sort of fulfilling. But I suppose, especially during the editing,
yeah.
I thought a lot about the reader, and I knew that this book could maybe get confusing or frustrating. So I really went to work and tried to make it, you know, despite being a bit of a puzzle, as I believe the Toronto Star said, which is very fair. despite it being kind of a puzzle, I wanted it to be an accessible one, you know, one that people kind of want to really assemble and think it's worth the effort as opposed to discarding. So, thinking of the reader really was a serious consideration all throughout the first and second edits. And so naturally the first draft was about 130,000 words, and it changed so substantially that I think the final is now about like 80,000. So it changed quite a lot. And I think the consideration for the reader was a huge, you know, was a big, I guess, aspect kind of informing that edit.
So this is the first novel. Were there, say, was there an unpleasant experience along the way in terms of whether it's the writing or the editing or the publishing that you're cognizant of now that will, say, be a little bit easier when you're working on the second one, say?
I think that once you finish a first draft, you feel like you're done, because it's such a big deal,
right?
And because, you know, and as done as it's going to be, right? And you're kind of like, yeah, wow, you know, you half expect like a big handful of confetti to fall down out of nowhere on you at your desk, you know, but nothing happens, and then you put it away for a week or two, and you tell everybody how happy you are about having finished. Having finished that draft, and then you read it again, and you realize it's terrible, and you realize that you have an even bigger, arguably, task in front of you, which is you know, the editing. And I think that I don't think I realized that as I was just trying to finish the first draft, which is probably a good thing, you know, because I got to sort of take it one step at a time. And so the importance of the edit, I think, will stick with me for the next project. In terms of publishing, I did learn that the publishing world often works at a pretty glacial pace. So, you know, you submit something somewhere, and you submit your manuscript somewhere, and you wait for a couple months, and that's, you know, that's normal.
Yeah.
You might wait so long that you're going to forget that you ever submitted it. So there's that. I think those two things they're fairly salient. I'm going to keep those in mind.
So that's good. It hasn't dissuaded you from doing another project, right?
Oh, not at all. Yeah. Not at all.
Yeah. What have you learned in terms of say narration, in terms of what a second novel will read like or will sound like, from whose voice after doing Mooncalves the way you did?
The next project is a book of short stories, I'm about 40% through the first draft. Mm-hmm. And so it's entirely different. I mean, it's sort of a different question, I guess, for short stories. But I guess from a narrative perspective, they're a bit more conventional. They all sort of center around the theme of love, but so far each story has just had one narrator, and you know, sometimes it's kind of an omniscient narrator, and sometimes it's kind of first person. But they're a little bit more straightforward. So maybe that's a bit of a reaction to Moon Calves and just kind of being wanting to try something a little bit simpler, or you know, who knows? But, yeah.
And I'm talking to you're in Duncan this afternoon. Mm-hmm. That I'm speaking to you, and so you've traveled you've traveled across the country then, talking about this book, haven't you? The last few days, right?
I've traveled across the country, and what was the second part?
What was it like to see the country these last few days?
Oh yeah, oh God, it's so beautiful. I had an event in Kingston, and then I flew straight to Vancouver for mm-hmm. an event at Massey Books.
Yeah,
Vancouver, which is wonderful. Of course, it's about a 5-hour flight, and I'd never been further west than Edmonton, and I was just floored at just how geographically big this country is, and I feel quite humbled by just the sheer amount of incredibly talented people that I've met in the last week and a half. Such different voices, such beautiful voices. I've been sort of touring with four other people, and we've been holding events across BC.
Mm-hmm.
And gosh, it's been just wonderful to learn from them and to hear their beautiful voices. And so, yeah, I would say humbled is a good word for it. And I feel very lucky as well.
Well, you should be very proud of this book. It's a fine achievement. Congratulations on it. It's been such a pleasure to speak with you today. All the best.
Thank you so much. Thank you very much.
The book is called Moon Calves. It is published by Now or Never. Victoria Hetherington, its author, joined me on the line from Duncan, British Columbia in Vancouver. I'm Joseph Plata.